This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Donald Trump's executive order on immigration last week left thousands of international students on college campuses feeling uncertain about their future. More than 17,000 students currently enrolled in the U.S. are from the seven countries listed in the travel ban. In North Carolina, university officials are encouraging students from the seven countries not to travel outside the U.S. Meanwhile, protesters gathered at Duke Chapel earlier this week to speak out against the ban, and UNC faculty have called on the administration to do more to protect international students. On today's program, we'll take a look at how changing immigration policies are affecting higher education. And joining me now is Sarah Brown. She's a reporter for the Chronicle for Higher Education. She's been covering how the travel ban is affecting college campuses. Sarah, welcome back to our program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
How have you seen college and universities try to process this order?
Yeah, so colleges have been really scrambling since Friday evening and working throughout the weekend to respond to this. You noted 17,000 students total. You know, the number of students affected by the executive order is not a large percentage of the total student population at most campuses. For example, I was reporting at West Virginia University earlier this week, and there it's 127 students affected out of nearly 29,000 total. But it's still a significant number, and most colleges, like the ones in North Carolina, have been basically saying, if you're from one of these seven countries, don't leave the United States until we know more. And beyond that, one of the first priorities for international student offices was figuring out if any students affected by the ban were out of the U.S. when the order was signed. And if so, you know, encouraging them to return as soon as possible. Colleges were also hearing from students who were thinking, what's going to happen to me even if I'm here now? Are federal authorities going to come to campus and send me out of the country? You know, I had planned to go see my family over spring break. Now what? And campuses were also hearing from students who are from other countries in that region, you know, like Saudi Arabia, for example, who also sends a lot of students here. And they're wondering, is my country going to be next to be added to this travel ban list? And if so, when?
Well, what about that second part of that question? Are they going to come for me? Because the volatility and the unpredictability of this administration certainly throws everything into question. He didn't even prepare his own administration. So you have a right to question kind of what's next. What kind of ripple effect does that have on universities that have to advise not only them, but all international students who have a right to be afraid under Donald Trump?
Sure. So colleges are definitely concerned about the long-term ramifications of this order. There's some concern, first of all, that it will be extended beyond the 90 days and expanded to other countries. And think if both of those things happen, that would have pretty big implications for international students who are either enrolled in American universities or have committed to universities here and are supposed to take classes in the fall. And beyond that, you know, colleges, particularly research universities like UNC Chapel Hill, are really worried about the broader chilling effect here. The U.S. has a reputation in higher education circles as a sort of haven for students and scholars from all backgrounds to learn, to conduct research, to teach, and to collaborate. And students from these and scholars from these seven countries are doing a lot of research work here, often in high demand fields like science, technology, engineering, and math. And those are also fields where collaboration is really important. So if the U.S. loses those people, that's a major hit to academia.
There's the potential of losing people who are already here. What about the impact on recruitment? Have you heard from colleges and universities that they're afraid this is going to have an impact on recruiting high quality students?
Definitely. So they're worried about the loss of talent potentially here. And again, not only from countries who, you know, are currently affected by travel restrictions or might be in the future, it also might have a chilling effect on students from other countries who might say, well, maybe the U.S. isn't welcoming of international students, and maybe I'll go to Canada or maybe I'll go to Western Europe. There are lots of other options for students to study. And I think that's certainly something that colleges are concerned about right now, looking forward.
Tell us what you've been hearing from students. Now, we've been looking at what the administration's having to do, but I know you know of at least one Syrian student who was scheduled to come to the U.S., and I'm sure you have other stories. What are you hearing from students?
Sure. So there are quite a few, specific stories of students who have been affected or in some way by the travel restrictions. One example of something that I heard was, so a Syrian student who is actually here right now told me that her fiance was supposed to come here from Syria to audition for a music music school in the next couple of weeks. And of course, he's no longer able to do so. And so he's probably going to lose the opportunity to go to graduate school here, at least for the time being. So that's one. There are, you know, other examples of students who just went home for winter break, were home in January visiting their families, and they're just unable to return and take classes this spring. You also heard from faculty members who were out doing research in the field or out at academic conferences in other countries, and they're scrambling to figure out how to get back in. So there are certainly, you know, a range of stories from people who say they're going to be they're being affected by this ban.
Well, let me know if I have this right. I understand that the majority of the international students from the seven countries who are banned at the moment are from Iran. And if that's true, can you tell me, you know, why that might be true and what effect this might have on our connection between U.S. and Iranian students?
Sure. So it is the majority of students affected by the travel restrictions are from Iran. So you mentioned, again, 17,000 roughly students from those seven countries. More than 12,000 of them are from Iran. And most of them are in doctoral programs here. So they're, you know, getting their PhD. I think the major draw for Iranian students is the strength of the science and engineering programs in the United States. And so, you know, despite poor relations between America and Iran in general, this is really a destination for Iranian students.
You recently reported on West Virginia University, as you said earlier, in the response of the executive order. Tell me about this, because that's an interesting place to go to do your research. Tell me what you found in West Virginia.
Sure. So you're right. It is an interesting place because on the one hand, you know, universities are generally seen as pretty liberal places. But West Virginia as a state voted nearly 68% for Donald Trump. And so obviously there are people in the state who support at least some of the travel restrictions that the president put in place. And about half of West Virginia University students are from the state. So I didn't see much support for the policy on campus in obvious ways. You know, the people who were on Monday coming out to the forum and to the vigil, you know, they were pretty upset about it. But there are definitely people there who think the policy is a good thing and they think it's going to help national security. Most of that support I saw, though, was on social media. You know, there didn't seem to be folks out and about on campus who were, you know, obviously showing support for the policy.
Can you tell us what was happening on that campus in terms of support? What kind of services did you see marshaled in West Virginia at the university?
Yeah, so the International Student Office there was working again throughout the weekend, responding to calls and emails from students. The university ended up finding that all of their students were in the U.S. when the order was signed. So that wasn't a concern. But they're you know, holding individual meetings for students from each of the seven countries. They're also holding meetings for students from, you know, other countries in that region who are concerned about what's next. You know, they're trying to help them work through legal questions. But in some cases, they're saying, you know, if you have really complex legal queries, you probably need to contact a lawyer.
Well, and this is from the flagship university, West Virginia, of course, which means they probably more legal services and capacity than other schools. So how have you seen schools differ in terms of their capacity to deal with the question?
Yeah, so major research universities like UNC Chapel Hill, for example, they tend to have several immigration specialists in the International Student Office. West Virginia University also has that. Many of these schools also have law schools, and the law schools have clinics where you can get legal advice. But even West Virginia University, you know, brought in an immigration lawyer on Monday to come to the forum and answer questions from the campus community. And so, you know, and that's again, as you said, a flagship institution. So I think some of these questions are just beyond what colleges are equipped to answer.
Are things settling down? I mean, again, we're not talking about huge percentages of the campus. I mean, obviously, they're proportionally, they have resources to deal with that small percentage. But are things calming down now? Or, as you say, there could be a cascade effect, I suppose, and things becoming more confused as more and more people worry about what this might mean for them. So I'm wondering what the trend is at the moment.
Yeah, so I think, you know, over the weekend and even going into Monday, colleges were sort of in crisis management mode. I think that is starting to calm down a little bit. But, you know, I think people are still sort of waiting apprehensively to see what President Trump will do, right? I mean, there was not a lot of clarity necessarily around what exactly the order meant. You know, would it affect green card holders, for example? And it wasn't really clear if border agents were enforcing it in a standardized way across the board, right? So there's still sort of that element of uncertainty, even as things, you know, the news and the chaos has started to calm down a little bit, but there's certainly still a lot of uncertainty there.
As spring break approaches, I wonder what this means for college campuses. If your advice is not to go home, that means you're going to have to, I suppose, figure out ways to house students on campus when the campus is essentially shut down.
Yeah. So, you know, at this point, 90 days definitely does affect spring break. And if it's extended in any way, it's definitely going to affect students' ability to go home over the summer. So most colleges have the ability to provide summer housing in on-campus dorms and apartments. The question is really cost. And I could see some, you know, universities offering housing free of charge to these affected students, especially given that it's not a significant number of them. But I haven't seen a commitment like that yet. I'll also add that there are professors in particular on campuses who are offering to pitch in. At West Virginia, one professor I heard about offered all of the spare rooms in his nearby house rent free to any students who weren't able to leave the U.S. for spring break or this summer. So you're seeing, you know, people offer up things like that.
I'm talking with Sarah Brown, a reporter for the Chronicle of Higher Education, who's been covering the travel ban's effect on colleges and universities. She'll stay with us as we continue our conversation about the travel ban and its effect on higher education. We'll continue the talk when we are joined by an administrator and a student from UNC Chapel Hill, and that conversation continues on The State of Things. From North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow, and on today's program, we're talking about Donald Trump's recent executive order on immigration and how it is affecting college campuses. We've been talking with Sarah Brown from the Chronicle of Higher Education. She's still with us. And joining me now is Elizabeth Barnum. She's Director of International Student and Scholar Services at UNC Chapel Hill. Welcome to the program, Elizabeth. Good to have you here.
Thank you. It's great to be here, Frank.
So we've been talking kind of in broad strokes about what's happening on college campuses. What happened at UNC Chapel Hill when this news hit the newsstands?
We had seen some advance drafts of the executive order during the week and had already started to digest it.
But that put you two steps ahead of the Director of Homeland Security, but go ahead.
Sure. So we started looking at this, and we were wondering what was going to happen. And, of course, it was about 4:45 in the afternoon on Friday when this was signed. But we were unable to obtain the actual signed document until early Saturday morning. At that point, we got together with the immigration attorney at the General Administration and our colleagues from UNC Global and around the campus to sort of digest what was going to happen and what we needed to do next. At that point, the university started preparing statements to send out to our constituencies and our campus and thinking about what we needed to do next. By Saturday afternoon, we put a notice about travel for people from those seven countries on our website, and by Sunday started phoning international students and scholars from the seven countries to say, you know, are you aware of what's happened? Do you have planned travel? If you have planned travel, don't travel outside of the United States now until we know what all of this means and what could happen. Fortunately, none of the non-immigrant students and scholars were planning travel or were outside of the United States. And I think at that point, as a student from Iran said, he was experiencing the bewildering uncertainty of what might happen next. And that's really how we all felt. We were bewildered, we were uncertain, and we continue to try to unpack how all of this will be implemented.
So at UNC Chapel Hill, how many students and scholars, we're talking about students and scholars as well, how many people are affected?
So we have less than 50 that are non-immigrants, but all of us are affected. So the kind of impact has to do with also our permanent residents and citizens from those countries, as well as our extended friends, family, colleagues. And, you know, Frank, when you've been in this business as long as I have, whenever you hear the name Iran or Iraq, I see the face of a student that I've known and cared for over the years, and as well as our current students. They're people that we know well, people who our faculty have collaborated with research.
But that's what I want to ask you. Forgive me for interrupting, but sure. How does it affect people who are not named or from the named countries in the ban?
So let me give you an example. Say you're a U.S. citizen and you're from one of the countries and you get a sudden phone call or a permanent resident, say, or an H-1B temporary worker, and you get a phone call from home saying, your mother's ill, you should come now, and you want to be at that person's bedside, or you're planning a family wedding and you would like a family member to come to the United States to be there for those really important family events. And now if that individual has to come from one of those countries, they're now unable to travel to the United States. And also people in non-immigrant status are unable to travel home to be with family and friends for important life events.
Their Chancellor Carol Folt released a statement earlier this week. Part of that statement is that, quote, this is a very fluid situation. Two federal courts issuing temporary stays against the order just yesterday. No one is really certain on how this will resolve in the coming days. Nevertheless, while the full impact of the order remains unclear, we're determined to help people who are directly or indirectly impacted in every way. There have been some stirrings on campus, faculty members in particular, saying this didn't go far enough to reassure students. How are students feeling about administration support for their condition?
I think that any outreach at this point is welcome. In the last few days, I've received phone calls and emails and outreach from members of our community and also our faculty and administration saying, is there anything we can do now? What kind of support do we need? And at this point, some of it's just getting information out, and our colleagues at UNC Global and throughout the university and my staff have gathered together to try to get information out. So information is important. It's so fluid that as soon as we get something drafted to put out, it's changed already. So we're working on that. I have to say, I've gotten some really heartfelt outreaches of support from the community, including the parent of one of our students, a U.S. citizen, who's contacted three immigration attorneys in Charlotte in case any of our UNC family gets stuck at the airport and needs immigration assistance. So I think one of the really positive things is that our Carolina community is really there for students and scholars and faculty and all of our colleagues who are impacted by what's happening.
Well, as you say, you talk about the broader community that's affected by any sort of discriminatory ban like this. Joining me now is Hiba Alzoubi. Hiba Alzoubi is a student at UNC Chapel Hill. She's a member of the Students Muslim Student Association. Hiba is a U.S. citizen and has family and friends that are affected by the travel ban. Hiba, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
As you said, you're a United States citizen. You're a member of the Muslim Student Association. But I wonder what went through your mind when you heard about the executive order on Friday.
Well, first was disbelief and shock. I mean, this wasn't The Onion. It was all over the news. And the media didn't even shy away from saying that this was the Muslim ban. That's how clear it was. The fact that something so arbitrary and unjust could go into order so fast just blew my mind. I mean, it didn't seem constitutional to me. And the fact that it just and inherently un-American.
Does it have, now you're, again, a U.S. citizen, so you sort of can't be directly affected by this. What are you hearing in communities, perhaps among Muslim students who have come from affected countries, who have family back there? What kinds of things are you hearing from them in terms of its direct impact on them?
For example, I have friends who, at UNC, who were just vacationing in Iran, and the ban was put in place while they were coming back. They're affected. But besides that, I do have family members who are in the U.S. without citizenships and are Syrian,
and they're directly affected by this.
You were born in New Jersey, in fact, yourself, but you did spend 5 years of your childhood in Syria. Yeah. Is that right? And now your family lives in Charlotte. So tell us more about your family's path to citizenship, and again, how this kind of ban and some of the rhetoric that has gone on around it, much of it is very definitely bigoted. And you heard in our billboard clip where Donald Trump says all Muslims are irrational and all Muslims hate life itself. Well, this is a bigoted statement. No matter when you paint this picture, he dialed back the ban on all Muslims. But this kind of language itself that is still in the works and still being reflected by the people who support him, what does that mean for you on campus?
It's definitely scary. It's almost saying as if we don't belong here, despite our citizenships, despite all the years we've spent in this country, everything we've done for it. My dad actually immigrated to New Jersey when he was 18. He was pursuing engineering at NJIT, and then my mom followed him. So we're all citizens, but I do have family members still in New Jersey who are only green card holders. And my aunt actually just came to the U.S. as a refugee with her husband and kids. So I'm just scared for what her kids will go through at school.
The language that Donald Trump has used over this campaign and into his presidency is very definitely bigoted, but he does reflect a concern that is a legitimate concern, which is the security of our borders. So, Elizabeth Barnum, let me ask you what the vetting process is for students who are international students who come to this country to study. Are we safe? What are you doing to make sure that we're securing our borders as we let these students in?
So, Frank, in 1996, there was an Immigration Act that basically established a student tracking system. That was even before 9/11. When 9/11 happened, the government implemented that in rapid order. So let me just outline what it takes for an international student to come to the United States. So all students have to apply to the university and go through that rigorous process to come to a good school like UNC Chapel Hill. In addition, international students have to take a test of English as a foreign language or some other test of English proficiency, and they need to show proof of financial support so that they have sufficient funds to support themselves throughout their stay in the United States. Once the student has been fully admitted by the university and we review their financial support documents, we prepare a certificate of eligibility for them to come to the United States, and the data is entered into a system called SEVIS, the Student Exchange Visitor Information System. Now, that's a big database that the Department of Homeland Security and Immigration and Customs Enforcement uses to track students throughout their stay in the United States. Once the student has been issued the form, we send it to them in their country. They apply for a visa appointment at a United States consulate or embassy overseas. And then the U.S. embassy or consulate goes through a series of security checks on that individual. They interview them in person. If there's any questions at all, the visa isn't issued until they are clear that that student is not a threat in any way to the United States. Once they've come to that conclusion, they actually issue the visa. The student can then board an aircraft to enter the United States and appear at the Customs and Border Protection for admission to the United States. At Customs and Border Protection, they're once again vetted by an immigration inspector at the port of entry. And if the immigration inspector, when they look in their database, has any flag on that student or scholar, and this applies to faculty and scholars as well, they go into a secondary inspection process where they continue to find out information until they determine that that individual ought to be admitted to the United States. Once the student leaves the airport, they then are required to report to campus, and we are required to go into that student database system and tell the government that, yes, they are on campus, here is their local address, and also to report that they're full-time students. Now, every time that student moves, within 10 days, we have to report that the individual has moved. So there's that tracking system that's very robust and already in place.
That followed a robust vetting system before you even got into the tracking system.
That's correct.
So thank you for that. Hiba al-Zuba, the UNC Muslim Association is organizing a rally tomorrow on campus to show support for those affected. Why is it important to do this, to create these spaces on campus and to keep attention focused on this?
Well, we definitely need a place for open dialogue so everyone can channel their emotions, discuss what they're feeling, how this is affecting them. I think also it's a place where people can show solidarity so we can know who's there, who's supporting us in this time, and to let people know that we belong in this country because this land is our land too.
You may find out who's not there and who's not supporting you, and I wonder how all of this, the rhetoric and the ban itself, is affecting the culture on campus for you.
The UNC Muslim Student Association has definitely been feeling the tension, the fear of this, how it's affecting their family members, or the kind of atmosphere it's creating on campus by saying that Muslims are feared. They're a threat to national security because all of these countries were Muslim countries.
Sarah Brown from the Chronicle of Higher Education is still with us. And Sarah, there were protests that took place earlier this week in front of Duke Chapel, here in Durham, North Carolina, to this executive order. Part of the protest included calling for Duke to be a sanctuary campus. Tell us more about this concept of sanctuary campus and whether or not the idea is spreading across the country.
Sure. So it's an idea similar to sanctuary cities, and basically campus officials who choose to say, you know, this is a sanctuary campus are saying that they will not cooperate with federal immigration authorities who try to deport their students. So it's sort of related to the immigration order debate, but a little bit different. It's usually, you know, again, brought up in the context of undocumented students. There have been a lot of demands for sanctuary campuses, for, you know, institutions to be declared sanctuary campuses, and sort of a range of responses from universities. It's definitely a minority of colleges that are actually sanctuary campuses. It's kind of a tough debate for college leaders to have. You know, ultimately, they don't have the authority to exempt their students, their institutions from immigration laws. And so I don't think, I think many colleges just don't want to make promises that they can't keep. And so some have chosen not to go as far as saying we are a sanctuary campus. Instead, they say, you know, here is how exactly we are going to support our undocumented students in this tumultuous time.
Well, you talk about some of the difficulties that college campuses are in these situations, particularly if you're talking about an executive order. How are you seeing, Sarah, differences in how the response to this in private universities versus public universities?
To some extent, the particular difference that I've seen is in more conservative states versus less conservative states. So, you know, colleges in places like Georgia and Texas, where state lawmakers have vowed to take action against sanctuary cities, you know, institutions there, both private and public, are not going to go anywhere near the sanctuary campus designation. And we sort of the same in West Virginia. So, you know, a student directly asked college leaders there when I was there on Monday, are you going to declare West Virginia a sanctuary campus? And they basically said, you know, we think that we're taking all the steps that we can possibly take right now. And so, you know, there are certainly some differences across the board. I think it's fair to say that private institutions may feel a little bit more empowered to declare themselves sanctuary campuses than a public institution. But the biggest differences I've seen have to do with the colleges, the state in which the colleges are in.
And apart from the question of whether to become a sanctuary campus, there are other legal considerations. Elizabeth Barnum is the Director of International Studies and Scholars Services at UNC Chapel Hill. I know that universities like Duke and UNC Charlotte have said they're not going to release records on international students. You talked about this big database, but there is some control over this owing to student privacy. Those two institutions have said they're not going to release records of international students without a subpoena. What's happening at UNC Chapel Hill?
So I think there's a lot of misnomers and a lot of confusion about what that might mean. All participants, all institutions that participate in having programs to have international students and scholars are required to provide certain information to the government, or you don't have a program. I mean, it's a condition. Students also sign, when they sign that form, they say, you know, the university will have to release information about certain things. It's a condition for being in that program. Now, that being said, there are also very good laws. One of them is the Family Educational Rights and Privacy Act that protects other types of records and protects records for students who aren't engaged in one of the international student or scholar programs that have those specific reporting requirements. So there's a lot of ways that this can be teased out. By saying you're not going to participate at all, I think is not correct for most of those campuses that have large populations of non-immigrant international students. But there are other types of information that would require a subpoena, if asked, and about other individuals that aren't in those CVIS programs. And I think that's where immigration law is so complicated and so nuanced. I mean, I just talked for a few minutes about how an F-1 student gets to the United States, but there are other rules for J-1 students and scholars and H-1B temporary workers and permanent residents, and it's so big and so complicated. It's very different than law enforcement coming to maybe pick up an undocumented student, which is a whole other set of issues and regulations and laws and protections for individuals.
And we will talk about that in a few moments. But first, I want to thank my guests. On the state of things right now, Elizabeth Barnum is the Director of International Student and Scholar Services at UNC Chapel Hill. Hiba Al-Zubi and Sarah Brown are also with us. Hiba is a Muslim American student at UNC Chapel Hill. Sarah, a reporter for the Chronicle of Higher Education. Thank all of you for being on our program.
Thank you so much, Frank. It's been a pleasure to be here.
Just ahead, we're going to take another look at a facet of immigration policy, deferred action, and its effect on young Americans and young adults in America. Stay tuned.